Okay, good morning everybody. Thank you for the invitation to this interesting symposium. I'm going to move a little bit more towards the human nutrition side and focus particularly on micronutrients. Okay, for my introduction, I'm going to take the background from this publication you can see here on the right. It's from 2016, Food Systems and Diets. And that will be my sort of background to why micronutrients are important. But also then I'm going to move on to look at the evidence for changes in micronutrient density in cereals with some experiments and some observations. Then I'm going to talk about the concept of geonutrition, which I'll describe when I get there. And then finally talk a little bit about the Africa Soil Information Service and the developments there in analysis. So by way of background, the nutritional crisis, this is taken, as I said, from that report on food systems. We've heard already, so I don't have to spend much time on this, the malnutrition, stunting, wasting, deficiencies of vitamins and minerals, but also obesity. Overweight, obesity, and diet-related chronic diseases are occurring, such as diabetes and hypertension. So malnutrition does actually kind of include overnutrition as well as, if you like, undernutrition. So concentrating on undernutrition, 25% of children under 5 years of age today are stunted and have physical and mental capacity issues. And also those who are born will be left with lifelong impairments. So more than about 2 billion people lack micronutrients. The ones that have been mentioned coincidentally by previous speakers, particularly iron, zinc, and vitamin A, which affects life and health. So in the Food Systems and Diets report, malnutrition was identified as the number one factor in the global burden of disease. And it was also stated that food systems are not delivering healthy diets. So that takes me to the next topic, which is what's been happening to diets and particularly staple crops like cereals. This is taken from the 2015 paper by De Vries et al. In Science, and you can see here that the production of food has gone up. That's the big block of brown, and it needs to go up even further to feed people, obviously, globally. The protein supply seems to, if anything, have decreased slightly. Zinc is the next one, which seems to have decreased slightly, and iron has gone down, particularly in global cereals over time. Now, I'm not sure where the data comes from this, but what it's saying is that there is a decrease in the nutrient density and that there has not been a focus on actual nutrient content. There's been a focus only on yield in breeding operations. So that this has kind of been ignored and the nutrient density has decreased, and the concept was floated in this paper about breeding for nutrient yield rather than just yield. Okay. So let's have a look at some of the evidence. From our long-term experiments at Rothamsted here, this is called Broadbork on the right, which started in 1843, we have a sample archive. And from that archive, you can take samples, and there's also data on yield, harvest index, and by analysis, we were then able to look at the nutrient content in grain. So what I'm showing here is basically the yield on the top corner of contrasted treatments. Those contrasts are the dark dots here are the control. They've had no fertilizers added for 175 years now. The square is a full mineral fertilizer, which you can see the yield was much higher than control and then increased in more recent years to very high levels. And then there's another treatment here, which is farmyard manure, the round circles, which is also increasing. Now that increase from about the 1960s onwards was due to us introducing the short straw varieties. So this is the Green Revolution, if you like. Increased harvest index, which is shown here. All of them had a low harvest index until the short straw varieties came in. And then you can see a rapid increase as we went from semi-dwarf to more dwarf wheat varieties on the experiment. I'd like you to notice that actually that's taking place in all these treatments, including the control. the control here, even though the yield is about a ton per hectare, the same as it was for the whole time, the control here is also increased in harvest index due to the new short straw varieties. So, okay, what happened then to the micronutrient concentrations in the grain? Well, we were expecting to be highly conserved, as they were here for about, let's say, 100 or more years. And in fact, when you do the analysis, you can see quite a sharp decrease here. And this was quite shocking and kind of unexpected. For example, with zinc here, we can see that we weren't getting what we thought we would expect in wheat, so about 35, 40 parts per million. But in some of these treatments now, we're coming down to about 15 parts per million, so less than half the concentration that we had previously. We looked at this, that was a time course, of course, and also during that time, other factors have changed, including things like CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. We then had a look at our trials with different lines of wheat in the UK, grown in 1 year, this is 2004, and you can see again here a relationship between iron in the grain, iron concentration, and grain yield, concentrations decreasing with increasing grain yield, all grown at the same time. And then there's evidence from the US, this is from winter wheat varieties grown in Kansas in 98 and 99, and these are lined up here basically in order of their year of introduction. From older varieties, roughly about 100 years they were introduced, until more recent varieties to 1999. And you can see, because they've been lined up in year of introduction, there is a trend here in iron and zinc concentration at two sites here in Kansas. So again, in another place, evidence of being grown at the same time of a decrease. And then finally, this paper by my colleague Peter Shuri, in Rothamsted in 2014 and 15, varieties again were grown side by side at the same time. They were introduced over more than a 100-year period, and you can see here again the concentrations of iron and zinc are decreasing, and they were able to fit a curve to this to show that there is a general decrease over time. So I think there is evidence that there's a decrease in micronutrient concentrations. The next subject I want to introduce is this concept of geonutrition. So, okay, we've been talking just now about what's been happening on the plant side of things, but what happens on the soil side is particularly important, I think, and for nutrition of humans. So several people have mentioned the kind of geo side of this. So the geo for me in geonutrition is geographic, geospatially resolved information, including a lot of multivariate information about geochemistry and also information about climate, etc. Because all of these, as Gary pointed out in his introductory talk, all of these affect performance and uptake and therefore the nutrition which is coming into our crops. And it relates to really the soil crop transfers, the dietary intake which comes from that. And actually what we would like to do is to link the geonutrition to human biomarkers. So just as an example, this year in Ethiopia, in an area of Amhara province, we're putting together data layers like this, which is basically soil information, so multivariate information, with crop concentrations, with diets locally, and then with human nutrition data, which we already have human biomarker data. And we're trying to put that together in terms of linking the environment, if you like, and the conditions to human nutrition. So I just want to do an example now on selenium, and I'll talk very briefly on zinc. So for geonutrition, in the UK, first of all, we know that we have very low selenium concentrations in wheat. This is a survey we did in three different years, and just by way of interest, I've put the required concentrations of foodstuff. And basically most of our wheat is down here. This is 20 ppb of selenium. To put that into context, most US and Canadian wheat samples contain about 370 to 700 or so ppb. So a huge difference in concentrations. When we look at the soils in the UK, I've put a kind of blue box on here where we grow most of the wheat. And you can see from the colours there, the blue and the light yellow, really low concentrations in the soil in the wheat growing areas. And this is really quite efficient on a world basis in terms of what sort of concentrations that we have in our soils. Also of interest there is that if you look outside the box, so to speak, these areas in the west and the south here have actually quite high concentrations. So actually this is the first indication that there's a climatic influence on the selenium concentration in soils, which we thought was very interesting. And so we formed a group that did a global study predicting topsoil concentrations from a lot of information on climate and soil, etc., pH and organic carbon, etc., etc. And what we did here, just very briefly, was to look at what might happen due to changes in the future in the climate. And basically, to cut a long story short, the aridity index, as we called it, the change in the climate with climate change scenarios, actually changes the selenium concentration in the soil. And the red is where the biggest changes are. And you can see there are large changes in South America and Africa, even in Europe and out in Asia. So the concentration in the soil is actually affected to a certain extent by the climate, again bringing in these multivariate factors into nutrition. And then just to continue in Malawi, these are colleagues from Nottingham University. Alan here got his PhD and he's now back working in Malawi. Paired soil and crop samples from Malawi. And the interesting thing here is that the total selenium in the soil varies quite a large variation, as you can see. And the concentrations are really, in a lot of soils, are really quite low. But you could see in this data set that there were two populations. Essentially, nearly all the soils gave very low concentrations. So this concentration in maize grain, 20 ppb, is a bit like the UK wheat, very low. But in the area which had Utrecht verticils, we've got at least 10 times as much in the crop in this type of soil. And looking at all the factors behind that, soil pH seemed to be the most important one, because of course selenium is an oxyanion and its availability increases with increasing pH. And of course it was these verticils which have higher pH which have the highest selenium in the crop. So it's nothing to do with fertilizer, it's just what the basic properties are of the soil. And then linking that to people, dietary intake was calculated. And you can see here most of the districts were giving really low dietary intakes, but in that Shira Valley where they have these Utrecht verticils, much higher dietary intakes were observed. And human status, so this is blood plasma measurements of selenium, and you can see here the non-verticils and the verticils, and the average here, there's almost no overlap in the selenium status of humans due to soil type, soil conditions. So then what can you do? In the areas where you need selenium, it's really quite easy to apply selenium. It's very low amounts added, let's say grams per hectare, and a linear response here in maize as we've seen in wheat in the UK. So we can actually then say, if you can get selenium, small amounts can be used to actually to improve the diet in those areas which are particularly low. Zinc, I think I'll leave this to Ismail tomorrow. He's talking tomorrow at the symposium about zinc. I'll just summarize the fact that, as we've heard actually again from Gary's talk, it's really, we know the sort of conditions, calcareous soils, sandy soils, etc., which are going to lead to low bioavailability. And also how to overcome that with either fertilizer applications or with genetic modifications. But we have to realize, again, the soil conditions, the geo part of geonutrition, even the modified varieties might not be able to fulfill the full potential or the target zinc for human nutrition. So again, we have to think about fertilizers and other ways of overcoming low zinc bioavailability. So, and then finally, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Africa Soil Information Service. This is interesting because it's a way of providing geospatially explicit information quickly for quite large areas. And of course, Africa is a very large continent. And this is a project funded by the Gates Foundation, which is led by Rothamsted and includes ICRAF, QED and Cornell, Columbia University. So what APSIS is doing is basically, again, looking at these data layers. And these data layers can include older soil maps, a remote sensing, which is being used to map areas quickly, looking, for example, for cropping zones, which I'll talk about in a moment, and then coming in with field sampling and consistent protocols for sampling, and actually soil spectroscopy, which can be done in Africa. Again, it's impossible to do, for example, ICP in many countries, but you're looking for something which can be done cheaply and very rapidly to gain information on the condition of African soils and also crops. So we set up the same, what I call the dry spectral lab at Rothamsted. Just very quickly, we have mid-infrared, we have X-ray fluorescence, we have X-ray diffraction, and we have laser particle size analysis. And we're actually then, we're having the same equipment in Africa and at Rothamsted for us to act as a reference lab, particularly for the wet chemistry. And we've been doing the calibration between the dry spectral measurements and wet chemistry on plant materials. You can see a huge range of different standards, fertilizers, and also soils. Again, you can see the huge range of soils which we've been using. And calibrations, just quickly, this is for plant material. The calibrations between wet chemistry and XRF here for potassium, phosphorus, and zinc are very good, and we're busy with the other elements down the line. Like I said, it has to work in Africa, so APSIS has labs in collaboration with Ghana, so GARSIS, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Tanzania, ICRAF has labs, and of course we have labs at Rothamsted. And here are the labs and the equipment that's being used in these labs in Africa. And there's also a sample archive here, which we've been busy exploring this year. Out in Tanzania, this is the TANSIS lab, a visit that we made back in April this year. The techniques for drying, for grinding, and then for subsampling, and then actually this is the mid-infrared analysis. And the whole lab is run by Isaac, and it's possible to do this, as I said, in Africa, as long as you have some power. It's possible to do all these things without digesters, without pure gases, without pure acids and all the rest of it. You can actually do this in Africa. So what can it be used for? Just very quick examples. This is concentrating here on pH. This is predictions of where the soil is less than pH 5.5. And the answer is it's about 450 million hectares. And you can see particularly where they are here. What's more interesting, I think, is to then say, okay, with our geosurvey, which is remote sensing, where are the main cropland areas in Africa? And we can see here there's an estimate of the total cropland area. It's about 6.7 of the 30 million hectares in Africa, about a fifth of the land is being used for crops. And then to cross these over, so crop present and pH less than 5.5 works out at about 85 million hectares. And these are highlighted in red on the map here, in West Africa, Central Africa, and quite large parts of Ethiopia. And again, this is useful because as a constraint on crop growth or also on nutrition, you need to know where you have acid soils. And then actually, if there's going to be any use of lime, governments then know where to actually pitch the effort, where exactly, which regions, which geochemical locations need lime and which don't need lime. Further uses, this is from Ethiosis, our colleagues Tegbaru Belete, gave me this example for an Ethiopian province. And again, they're using these techniques to measure a whole lot of nutrients. I'll just zoom in here on zinc. You can probably see some color at the bottom of the map here, which is the zinc deficient area. The green is the more sufficient area. And then going to blending special fertilizers. Again, the ones with zinc tend to be the reds and the blues and the greens. And again, based on this information, you then recommend it for the southern areas of the province and not the areas which have apparently higher zinc availability. So again, it's targeting using the geochemical and spatial information to target where the fertilizers will actually be used. And then actually blending plants. There are five blending plants which are open in Ethiopia, and they're blending those particular blends and different mixes specific to the region and to the properties and the geochemistry of the soil. And then you can go out and do the verification trials, so verification in the field from your prediction. And this is just one example of the standard practice, which is DAP and urea only, so no micronutrients, no sulfur. And this is a mix which includes those and sulfur and micronutrients. And you can see here for wheat the enormous difference between the crop performance. And so these verification trials, if you like, are being done in different provinces to test the fertilizer recommendations. So, okay, finally, I just want to make some conclusions. We know that the micronutrient concentrations depends on the variety, the genotype effect that I was talking about with short-strawed varieties, high-yielding varieties. We know it depends on soil conditions, but also it depends on climate. So what we need to do is to get this multivariate data together to then actually predict where we need nutrients, or in fact, as I've shown, where we don't need nutrients to be added. The biofortification is important, and the need and the methods to achieve biofortification, again, it depends on the nutrient of interest. So selenium is very different to zinc, for example, and on the local conditions. Those local geochemical conditions are particularly important. And then finally, what I've been talking about, particularly with the APSIS part, is how you can do diagnostics and analytics using kind of big data to get predictions of these transfers and actually what then goes into diet and the status of humans. Putting all of those together, I think, is a really exciting area. And a spatially explicit basis is particularly important here. Because then you can actually tailor the interventions, whether that they're on the soil and the agronomic side or on the human side, so it might actually be supplementation of humans. You can then put those interventions into the right position, in the right location in the landscape. And I think that's all I have for you. Thank you. Selenium has many effects. There are 25 enzymes in the human body which have selenium in them. And selenium fights against infection, so it has effects on the immune system. It has effects on health and development, cognition. And there is recent evidence that it has effects particularly on things like the fragility index with people aging. There are a whole bank of things which are related to selenium status.
That's not something everybody
can test for. Well, selenium in plasma is quite a good biomarker. And so, for example, glutathione peroxidase, which is one of the selenoenzymes, we know the optimal range of plasma selenium for that particular enzyme. And we know that in quite large part of Europe, and actually now we know in parts of Africa, the diet or the plasma is much lower than the optimum for that enzyme, and maybe many of the others as well. Sorry, I forgot to put up the final slide, which is my collaborations in the UK, and also our colleagues in Malawi and Ethiopia, where we have ongoing projects on geonutrition and the funders for this work. Sorry about that.
Steve, thank you for the presentation. For the work period that you're doing in Africa, with the correlation of AXA-F measurements with the regular methods, such as chemistry, I believe it's for Toto, are you trying to do a correlation for Toto comparing the STD as a detection of STD measurements? The extra help for different classes, and And second question, are you trying also to do a correlation of available index for phosphorus, zinc, etc., with total measurements done by
Yes, is the answer. We have to get a wide range of soils, because if you know about the spectral measurements, you need a wide range of variation to do your prediction. And then we do the wet chemistry on either total or extracts like Mealic-3, for example. But your question raises an even bigger question, which is, how good are those extracts? Any extract is a chemical extraction. It doesn't equal bioavailable. I believe actually the bioavailability is an algorithm which includes all of the soil properties. So, you know, pH, organic carbon, some extract maybe, and different aspects of the soil give you what ends up being bioavailable. It's not really coming from one extract. And I think that's been shown time and time again. One extract might work in a limited situation, but when you go to a wide range of conditions, it doesn't predict very well what's the availability.
That's why I asked you if you're trying to separate phosphoacids. By doing that, you probably want to separate phosphoacids.
That's part of the multivariate information. So, as I tried to suggest, we do need some climate information, soil class information, as well as, you know, pH, organic carbon, rainfall, etc., to say, okay, what gets through to the diet, what gets through the diet then to the people, is actually dependent on a multivariate range of factors. And I actually don't believe that one soil extractant is going to tell you in all conditions.
Zach Stewart, Kansas State Sustainable Innovation Lab, a really nice presentation. But my question is, looking at the soil available micronutrients and if there's anything being looked at for how much of the zinc or iron is actually being partitioned to the endosperm or the bran or the germ, because those mild-out fractions are really important for what piece is actually consumed in the diet versus just the agronomic biofortification of the whole grain.
If I may, I put in a couple of extra slides which relate to this very question. We now have techniques, so for example, if you know ICP-MS, particularly LC-ICP-MS, you can fractionate the grain basically and measure different species of some of these micronutrients of interest. But there are also more solid state methods, like this is NanoSims, which have been developing to look at the location of selenium and also zinc and iron in different parts of the grain. This happens to be the alurone on the left and the endosperm on the right, to show where these elements are. And the selenium is actually mainly in the endosperm here, and I think I brought along a picture for iron. So iron here is located in alurone layers and particularly associated with phosphate. As you can see, this is the phosphate signal and this is the zinc signal here. So again, there are techniques for measuring or fractionating the grain. Of course, you can mill the grain and you can work out what's left in different fractions of, say, white flour. You can then do ICP-MS and you can do NanoSims. So I think we have all the technology now with any new varieties, or when we're trying to agronomically biofortify, to say where did the zinc and where the selenium goes and how that gets through into the diet, or it might get lost if people are eating the white stuff, the endosperm. Yeah, this is a totally different subject. So arsenic is really only an issue where you have flooded soils and crops like rice, which are going to accumulate arsenite, as we showed. Selenium, we're not really looking at the interaction directly, but we do know that in rice diets where people are taking a lot of arsenic through the rice, they're also depleted in selenium, which is not good, because the selenium and other micronutrients are going to help, you know, the health and the well-being of this the individuals who are exposed. So those sort of interactions, I think, are important, but I do see them as completely separate, because most of the selenium issues are from areas of the world which have aerobic soils and deficient soils, and we need to boost the selenium in the material, and that's totally separate from the arsenic issue in my mind.